Welcome, friends, and thank you, as always, for your interest and for your coming back week after week for Economic Update. This is Richard Wolff. I come to you each week with an attempt to analyze the economic events of the recent past, to provide some context, some analysis, and an explanation of where these kinds of events are leading us, both as a country and as part of the world economy. As your host, as you know, I've been a professor of economics all my adult life at several universities, and I currently teach at the New School University in New York City. I also write regular columns for the organization Truthout, and I urge you to take a look at their remarkable website, truthout.org, where you will find intelligent, independent, critical news and analysis discussed simply and clearly every day. Please keep sending in your comments and questions, as I say each week. They are important shapers of this program. I select only a couple to be responded to each week, and I do ask your understanding. We couldn't possibly respond to all of them. There are so many for which we are grateful, but that forces the choice on us. And as always, please consult our two websites. That's how you send in your questions and comments, and that's also how you can follow the kinds of stories and analysis being presented here. The first one is rdwolf2fs.com, and the second one is democracyatwork.info. Either or both of those websites will provide you a channel to reach us, to give us your thoughts and responses to the program, and in general, to pursue the kinds of analysis we do here. Let me turn then, before I introduce our guest for today, Laura Flanders, and more about her in a few minutes, to do the short updates with which I begin every program. The first one has to do with the results of a Gallup poll that was completed and the results reported last week. And this has to do with the retirement age of Americans. And there's something very important going on that needs to be discussed. 20 years ago, in 1993, the average retirement age in the United States was 57 years. Today, the average retirement age is 61 years. That's a big difference. In a poll also done back in 1995 of people still working as to when they thought they would retire, the poll result indicated that the average proposed retirement date was at age 60. This year, the same question asked of people working today, the answer they gave was that they thought they would retire at age 66. Well, these statistics show something, and that's worth a conversation. What they show is that more and more older folks are staying in their jobs. They are not leaving their jobs. They're staying. And this produces a number of results. First, it creates more difficulty for younger people just coming into the labor market, graduating from high school or college or graduate school, looking for work. There are going to be fewer slots for them because the people who used to retire, say, starting around 55, 56, 57, are not doing that, and in fact are planning to retire 5 or 10 years later on average, which means many are going to retire much later because it's just an average. That closes off job opportunities to young people. But it has more impact than that. The older you are, other things equal, the higher the pay you get. And therefore, companies, as they find their elderly workers not leaving, are confronted with payrolls that are getting higher and higher because these are their top paid employees, giving them incentives, either to automate or to leave the country and find cheaper workers elsewhere. In other words, to respond to what the age growth means to them in terms of payroll. But here's the message I think is most important to understand. We've known for 20 years, that's what the Gallup poll teaches us, we've known that the older folks are staying in the job market. We should have planned for that. Even before the crisis of 2007 happened, there should have been the planning that took account of the decisions people are making to stay in the labor market and in the labor force at older and older ages. For example, to understand that we don't want a tension between old and young in our society, and that can become very ugly, as in, for example, politicians mobilizing younger people to get angry at Social Security for the elderly as a way to represent their upset about there not being jobs. That's already happening, and that has happened in other societies and produced terrible tensions. To avoid all of that, the government could have and should have planned. It should have created a wonderful opportunity for older workers to retire and get part-time or full-time paid work by the government in all kinds of new tasks, new careers, trained for that, to give their elderly lives the kinds of meaningful work that would have not only made their lives better, easier work in some cases physically, different work to engage different capabilities of people, but it would also have opened up the jobs that they left for the young folks. That would have been a rational plan. We didn't do that in this society. We didn't handle that problem. We have a system that doesn't know how to identify those problems, is ideologically opposed to the government taking the steps. No private enterprise took the steps that were necessary either. So we had a default of our private capitalist system and an accompanying default of the government that it sustains. This is a wonderful illustration, if you needed one, of a system knowing the problems coming down the line, having the possibility of creating creative solutions that would have been better for those older folks and better for the younger ones, and solve two problems at once, failing to do so in several of the ways that are available. My second update is very short. When I see a prominent person in the news able and willing to criticize the capitalist system, rather than treating it as a taboo topic that one can never say anything about, because capitalism has to be dealt with as if it were the best thing since sliced bread and beyond critique, which has been the norm in this country for 50 years. So when I see somebody prominent willing to make some critical remarks to open the space for a real debate our economic system ought to have had for all these 50 years, I jump on it. So I want to report it to you very briefly, nothing much to say. The words I'm about to quote were uttered last Tuesday by none other than the new Pope Francis. I'm going to read to you his words, as reported over all the mass media, but I am taking the information from the Washington Times, an article dated May 22nd, and the byline, Cheryl Chumley. Here's the quote from Pope Francis. A savage capitalism has taught the logic of profit at any cost, of giving in order to get, of exploitation without thinking of people. And we see the results in the crisis we are experiencing. What possible comment could I add? The third update for today. The OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, is an organization that has been around for many decades. It now includes 34 countries around the world, but mostly Europe, North America, and some Latin American countries, and some in the other parts of the world, mostly relatively advanced industrial countries. They do wonderful statistical work that I have reported on in this program many times and that I use all the time. And they released one last week that I want to bring to your attention. They measured income inequality across the 34 countries they represent. That is, they compared the income of the top 10% of the people in their country to the income of the bottom. And they asked, how far apart are they? Okay, and I don't have the time to go through the whole list, but if you go to OECD, you can find it for yourself. But I wanted to give you the results. The average, The country that came in at the exact average, Canada. In other words, roughly half the countries in the 34 have greater inequality than Canada, and half have less. But I thought you might also be interested if I listed for you the three countries with the least inequality, the five countries with the least inequality, and the five countries with the greatest. So let's start with those that are the least unequal, the most egalitarian five. Ready? Here we go. Iceland, Slovenia, Norway, Denmark, and the Czech Republic. How interesting. Two former communist countries, two Scandinavian countries, and Iceland, which literally stands alone. At the other end, the five countries with the greatest inequality of income. And by the way, this is all for the year 2010, which is the most recent date for which these numbers can be crunched and produced. Here are the five least equal, most unequal countries, going from the fifth to the worst. Fifth worst to the absolute worst. Fifth worst, Israel. Fourth worst, United States. Third worst, Turkey. Second worst, Mexico. First worst, Chile. Wow. The five most unequal societies include the United States. Tells you something about what has happened in this country over the last 30 years. We were not in that worst five 30 years ago. Not even close. Let me continue briefly. Last week, something else happened that I want to bring to your attention. This one has to do with an enormous demonstration in Rome, Italy. It had been organized by the Metalworkers Union of Italy, FIOM are their initials, and the CGIL, which is the largest trade union federation, roughly like the AFL-CIO here in the United States. The two unions organized a peaceful demonstration in Rome last week and drew over 100,000 people to the streets of Rome demonstrating. And what were they demonstrating for? They were against austerity. They were demanding jobs and a jobs program. They were angry with how long this downturn has lasted and the failure of either the private enterprise system or the government of Italy to do anything really about it. Unemployment is now 12%, and for people under 25, it is 38% in Italy, a staggering percentage. Why am I reporting on this to you? For two reasons. First, I want to always remind people that around the world there are lots of working people who do not take all of this lying down, who are not resigned to what is happening in the world economy, but are acting. And it's important that we all understand that that's the case. And the second reason I bring it up is a simple question. Why are these sorts of things not happening in the United States? It's an important question to ponder. We have here an unemployment, which our government tells us runs, depending on your estimates, between 18 and 25 million Americans are either without work and looking, without work and have given up looking, or forced to accept part-time work when they want and need full-time work. The Federal Reserve tells us that 20% of our industrial capacity is being unused. Machines, equipment, tools, space in a factory, gathering rust and dust. There's no excuse for any economy that can't put together the people who want to work, millions of them, and all the tools, equipment, and raw materials they could possibly need to produce an output that would solve our social problems. The greatest critique of any economic system is that failure. The Italian people are in the streets demanding something be done. Why not here? My final update, for which I have time today, has to do with two disasters in America that need your attention. Two school systems being savaged, all in the last week. First, we saw the closing of 49 schools in Chicago by Mayor Rahm Emanuel and his Board of Education. Particularly located in black and Hispanic neighborhoods, these are traumas for the parents and the children being forced to change their school locations, being forced into overcrowded classrooms, being disrupted in their life patterns, being made to travel long distances, often through dangerous areas. The parents, the school children begged to no avail. 49 schools, the largest school closing in American history ever anywhere. And as if to round out the picture last week in Philadelphia, we had a remarkable story. The story surrounds William Height, Jr., who is the head of the school, the superintendent of schools in Philadelphia. Their school budget, which has already been cut, is so savage that for the forthcoming year is a budget which, according to the Philadelphia newspapers, is so bleak that schools would not have counselors, books, or any extracurricular activities at all next year. The savaging of a school system. So desperate is the superintendent that he made the following proposal to the state government in Pennsylvania. If you will give us just enough money that we don't have to make these further cuts, my proposal is to cancel the seniority protections for teachers. In the past, you couldn't fire a teacher who'd been there 10 years or 15 years before you had to fire people who hadn't been there that long because you want to reward people who've learned on the job, who've adapted, who've developed, and who've become better over time. It was always the idea that to give the supervisors of school teachers the right to hire and fire at any age denied what you learned by doing, which all professions understand. So you give automatic increases. They're modest every year. These are to be taken away. No protections for seniority that have been struggled for by workers across the history of this country. So you have blackmail. To the teachers, we're going to blackmail you by denying you what you fought for. And if you don't do it, you will condemn the students to an inadequate budget for their education. What kind of a society does this? Okay, it gives me great pleasure now to turn to my guest for today. She is Laura Flanders. She is very famous. I am very lucky to have her with me. I've known her for quite some time. I want to tell you a little bit about her, and bear with me because there's a lot to tell before we go into our conversation. Laura is most famous, I think, for the whole institution known as Grit TV. She founded it, she organized it, she ran it for many years. She still works with it. It is an independent producer of all kinds of programming that has appeared across the country on various television stations. I was lucky enough to be interviewed a few times, as have been many, many others. She's a regular writer for The Nation magazine. Her work has appeared in These Times, The Progressive, Ms. Magazine. She has appeared on television programs more than I can count, but I'm going to just quickly list a few of them. The Lou Dobbs Tonight Show, The O'Reilly Factor, Hannity and Combs, enough said. Washington Journal, Donahue, Good Morning America, Countdown with Keith Olbermann, The Ed Show, Real Time with Bill Maher, and on and on and on. It is an extraordinary pleasure for me to welcome Laura as one of the premier independent and critical journalists working in the United States today. She's also the accomplished author of several books, but in order to give you a chance to hear her, I won't do the list. Laura, thank you very much for coming.
It's great to be with you, Rick.
Let me jump right in. I understand you've just come back from some work about a group of miners with a wonderful historical story in Virginia.
Yes,
Tell us about it.
Well, I just posted a story at grittv.org that people can find, or at thenation.com, about the brewing fight in the coal fields that isn't actually taking place in the coal fields. It's taking place outside a federal courthouse in St. Louis. Get that. It sort of speaks volumes about everything that you talk about on this program, about how our world has changed for labor. 24 years ago, there was a struggle in the coal fields that really was at the pit head gates of the Pittston Coal Company in Virginia, West Virginia, and Kentucky. Miners were being threatened with losing their retirement benefits, the guaranteed quality health care that the United Mine Workers of America has won for the guys who work underground and the few women over the many, many years of struggle of the last century. Pittston, the coal company, was trying to offload those retiree benefits. The people, miners, their families, Church leaders, communities showed up in the thousands, as did the press, to fight back that attack. They won, more or less. It's a complicated story. But they won, in essence. All these years later, that very same attack is happening again. And this time it's happening courtesy of a small little company that didn't even exist back then. It's called the Patriot Coal Corporation. The union says it was essentially created by a couple of big coal companies to be a place to dump that pension liability. And that's just what Patriot is trying to do. So they're in court saying, we're going bankrupt. They declared bankruptcy last July. And a federal judge now has to decide whether their claim is legitimate.
And if they got the bankruptcy, they would effectively escape making good on all those years of donations of the workers' money into that pension
23,000 miners and their families stand to lose their retirement benefits, and some other 1,700 active working miners stand to lose on the job benefits and working conditions. It's a huge struggle. Where's the media? They're barely blinking. And it speaks a lot about how what I call the kind of extreme capitalism of our era has come, that they are now targeting really a bastion of 20th century labor organizing, the United Mine Workers. If the United Mine Workers and what have been built over the years as good union jobs, maybe not glamorous, maybe horrible for your health, but good union jobs, if the companies can beat the UMWA and walk out on those jobs, heaven help the fast food workers.
That's right. Let me play my role as an economist and remind everyone watching or listening to this program that a pension is not something your company gives you.
Right.
It is not something that is a lovely benefit falling from the sky that someone else has to pay for. That's not what a pension is. Pensions have always been things established usually over the objections of an employer, by the struggles of the workers who needed to have something they could rely on when they crossed age 65 or whenever they retired. And the way it worked was when the workers got it, the employer said, all right, now we'll put money in, but it's your money. It's money we're not going to give you in a wage increase. And in countless bargainings for contracts, the union would accept little or no wage increase by instead accepting, as part of the gains they get from their extra productivity, from their extra hard work, they would get more of a contribution into their pension. So this is coming out of the workers' own pockets. So it to be taken away means that the company is taking away the benefit that the workers put the money into. And it's a kind of thievery.
The economic story is devastating and the human story is devastating because the human version of what you just described is generations of miners agreeing to do a job that keeps the lights on. It fueled our industrial revolution, runs factories from coast to coast, but which kills people, in exchange for that guaranteed health care. So that guarantee of health care,
especially in your elderly years when all the bad health comes through.
If you make it to your elderly years with your black lung disease and all the rest, these agreements that the unions have won from the companies have fueled not just individual plans, health care plans, but clinics in communities that have been entirely abandoned by our health service. These are, as the miners will say, the Cadillac of health care plans. They're very proud of it. That's what they've gotten in exchange for all that life-threatening work and bringing disease home to their families. That should be turned back now. It's this mounting to kind of rolling up Appalachia and throwing it away.
Right. And it's also the massive assault on the standard of living through the unemployment, through the cutting of the job security, to the temporary worker explosion in America where basically workers have no benefits at all, on and on and on. This is just another part of that story. In order not to leave people with a depressed sense.
Now you're worried about depressing them?
Let's change it around. Tell us a little bit about another story that you've been interested in. A group of workers in Chicago that I've talked about on this program in the past also, who faced the shutting of their enterprise as a capitalist enterprise, but instead of accepting it, instead of resigning themselves, instead of walking away and looking in a bad job market for another thing. They took a different step. Tell us a little bit about who they are and what they did.
Well, it's kind of related in the sense that here is a group of workers in Chicago who have been part of a union, the United Electrical Workers, for many years. They've done what they were told to do, signed contracts with their bosses, and they've watched two sets of owners walk out on their factory. Each for different reasons. The first, it looks like, was trying to reopen under non-union contracts and hire part-time workers just across town or move the equipment out of state. The second, well, they had stepped in the beginning of 2009. They had never been in the window business before. It was a stretch, and they didn't make it. The union workers looked around and said, as one put it to me, you know, Republic, the first owners, walked out on our jobs. Sirius, the second owners, walked out on our jobs. We didn't walk out on our jobs. We're still here. We know this company can be successful, and we're going to take it over. And for the last year, these are the same people who physically occupied their plant in 2008 so that the company couldn't just abandon it and steal the equipment. That was what got time for the second owner to come aboard. When the second owner left in 2012, they said, we're going to take it over in a different kind of way. We're going to create a worker cooperative, which is what they did, a little LLC, and we're going to raise the money to buy the equipment ourselves, move it to another location that's cheaper and better for us, and open it and see if we can't make a go of it. On May 9th, they opened that factory.
May 9th of this year.
Just 2 weeks ago. They open this factory. They're open for business. You can get more information at neweerawindows.com, and I wish them luck. Because they're keeping jobs in the community, and they are saying there is a different way to go. And they've learned an enormous amount in this process. You've got real leaders there who are going to benefit that community forever.
And, you know, again, let me just add a thought in the time that we have. This is something that could have and should have been done for the last 30 years. Every time an American capitalist enterprise shut down, whether it's an auto factory or a clothing factory or an appliance factory, anywhere in America, in should have come teams of union people, government people, helping the workers there to have an option, not simply to fold, not simply to try to hold on to their job by giving concessions, giving away their pensions, giving away their holidays, giving away their personal days or whatever it was, to have another option, to say, hey, we will stay here. We will continue this job. We will continue this enterprise as a co-op. And we'll go to the American people and we'll give them a real choice. You can buy from your fellow Americans who held on to those jobs and created a co-op, or you can save a few bucks and buy from that American company that's now ripping off workers in the rest of the world in order to save on the wages they used to pay to us. My guess is the American people would vote real clearly, and many a company that left the United States would never do that again.
And I know that you're the economist here, but the economic part of it is the overhead on a cooperative company is a world of difference from the overhead on a company that's having to pay shareholders. So if all that you're doing is redistributing your profits to the workers and maybe investing in your business and bringing on another line of machines and not paying off lots of different people that have invested and expected a 20% return, you can actually make a go of it in a climate like ours, in any climate. In fact, co-ops around the country, people like Gar Alperowitz report, are doing very well in this downturn.
Right. And the irony is American folklore would support that. Just ask yourself the question, how many corporations, in the typical capitalist way, discover that their workers are resentful of the top-down hierarchy that they live under, resentful of being excluded from all kinds of rights, resentful of the bad air that's in there and of the bad human relationships, so that the company responds by having to put layer upon layer of supervisor? All these people getting money that don't help produce anything but are trying to cope with the tensions of the difference between those who make the decisions and those who don't. Brilliant you don't have to be to understand if you got rid of all of that, if the workers were themselves the owners and operators of their enterprise, then they'd care a lot more. Then they'd be having a piece of that action would make them much more likely to help each other rather than feel bitter around each other. It's not hard to see why co-ops can be, as they have been, just as efficient, just as competitive, and often more so than their capitalist counterparts.
If you go to grittv.org, the program still continues online, you can see the interview I did with the workers a couple of weeks back, where they said, you know, we thought we were just window makers, but in this process we discovered we were carpenters and plumbers, we could lay tile and do the accounts.
We're going to take our usual mid-program break. But before we do, I want to give Laura a chance to say something about her forthcoming activity and panel at something I wanted to mention to all of you, which is the annual conference called the Left Forum. Happens in the spring of pretty much every year. It is the largest gathering in the United States of left academics and left activists talking about what they do, debating with one another the great issues of our day. It usually brings together 4,000 or 5,000 people in New York City and always at the same place, Pace University in Lower Manhattan. And it will be happening again this year, June 7th to 9th at Pace University. You can get all the information on all the topics and all the speakers, including Laura Flanders and myself, by going to leftforum.org. Laura, tell us what you'll be doing there.
Well, I'm happy to say I will be on a panel high noon on Saturday the 8th. So come down to Pace, high noon on Saturday. We'll have a showdown, although I don't know who we're showing down to exactly, on the second term of Barack Obama. My co-panelists are the very wonderful also economist Jeff Madrick, Ben Barber from the Interdependency Movement, and the extraordinary labor organizer and analyst Bill Fletcher. So I think we should have quite a great conversation. Watch out, Barack. And I hope that you'll join us.
We'll take our short break, and we'll be back in a couple of moments.
I'm so weary of taking up space. Send the junk mail to the whole human race. Stole my genome from the salt of the earth. Made my brain for to see what it's worth. Lights out, the throwing blocks of the bonfire. Beauty's burning by my backbone, feels so cold. Little girl with a protein hand. White lightning that she got from Japan. Fingernails and a taser gun. Mannequins just melt in the sun. Say hello. The throwing blocks at the bonfire. Plastic melts, but souls all the wear away. Timber pillars of salt, like missile silos where the alpha males go. Miles away, the throwing blocks at the bonfire. From the ashes of the left is a hot stone.
Welcome back. This is Economic Update. I am your host, Richard Wolff. I am talking with Laura Flanders, a well-known, globally independent journalist whose work on Grit TV and in many other venues is available to you. And you can also catch her at the Left Forum on the 8th of June. I wanted to continue our conversation by drawing her out a little bit about her remarkable journalistic career. Tell us a little bit, if you will, from your perspective, what do you think about the following, and I'm going to group a couple of things together. Are newspapers disappearing as part of our mechanisms of communication? Number one. Number two, does the internet represent some kind of breakthrough for independent critical journalism to have a space and an audience in the United States other than working through the large corporations that otherwise dominate the mass media? Two big questions people have been asking. How do you see that?
Well, Well, it's interesting, you know, because I think that this conversation about, oh, we're losing the newspapers, in it, we are, you know, treated to an enormous amount of hand-wringing. And there's something we tend to forget, which is the newspapers have been doing a horrible job for most of our lifetime. Not always. There are always great people trying to do a good job inside those institutions. We're talking about media. It's a plural noun. It's a multifaceted thing. But in terms of institutions, that the New York Times, the Philadelphia Inquirer, that the LA Times, the Wall Street Journal should lose a little power these days, I don't think that's anything the workers you and I care about are going to cry about. At the same time, there's no question that people who are coming out of journalism schools today, wondering where they're going to work, are finding themselves hard-pressed to find an answer. And I would suggest that that, too, contains part of the problem. One of the passions that brings me to journalism is the story I want to tell. I will find, as you have found, pretty much any way you possibly can to get that story out. I see journalism students today coming out of journalism school wondering where their job's going to be before they wonder what the story is going to be that they tell. Who are they wanting to talk to? Who are they wanting to hear from? And I think that when journalists in that sort of situation can come and work in independent media and learn some of the tools to use the new technology to get those stories out, then the new technology and the internet is a very glorious place because we can do things we couldn't do 30 years ago. We can have so many more options than the option to write an op-ed. We can get our story out by hook or crook if we team up with others, if we collaborate, if we get help from our friends and family. I just think sometimes we have to shift our way of thinking about it. Are our career prospects good? No, they're terrible. But are the possibilities that exist for us to get a story out, they're better than ever.
Okay, wonderful. No, that's very good.
That's the Pollyanna response.
No, let me push it a little bit. Do you think the internet has given us an audience that is sizable, that is significant, so that those of us who have a critical perspective can feel secure that the work we're doing is reaching people's brains so that they think about it, that it becomes part of how they understand the world, so they're not dependent on the big conventional mainstream media?
Well, think about it. I think it's a trade-off. I mean, I've worked in both. I've worked in commercial and non-commercial media. I worked at Air America Radio. I worked at Pacifica Radio. I've worked online. I've worked on TV. And I think about that kind of question all of the time. These days, when I go off to be a guest on a show like Melissa Harris Perry's or Chris Hayes's, I stop and think. They're doing good stories. They're doing pretty good reporting. But they have to do it between those commercial breaks. Whether there's somebody in head office telling them what to say or not, there usually isn't. That format of now we go to commercial break. Oh, and now we just came back from commercial break. And now we're going back to break again. Inhibits most kinds of intelligent conversation. You can have the best guests in the world, but how much can you say between those breaks with the clock running to get to the next ad because it's the ad that the broadcast is really about? So, yes, we can say, well, they have thousands of viewers and they no longer have millions. They have hundreds of thousands, and that's a lot, but it's not like the old days of network TV. And we have thousands of viewers, maybe tens of thousands, not hundreds of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands on a good day. But I do feel that the work that we're able to do on the internet because of the context, the format itself, gives us more choices and, frankly, gives audiences more choices. They can watch a small part and turn it off. They can watch the whole thing. They can get more information with the links that you provide. I mean, this is very basic stuff, but the ability to be able to share, to interact, to communicate is, again, a different planet from sitting at home throwing your shoe at the television screen or writing a letter to the editor that you find out 3 weeks later just hit the heap.
Yes.
I think, you know, it's a fascinating world. Do we have the same audience as corporate media? No, obviously not. Otherwise, they would give us TV and let us, you know, and take the internet. Do we have more tools? I think sure.
Yeah. And that's my experience as well, that I am amazed by those of you listening to this program, how you write to me, how you email me from literally all over the world. There clearly is a kind of diffusion of what we're doing that is wonderfully gratifying, even if we can't quantify exactly what it means.
I will say that not being able to quantify is very hard for fundraising. And that's in that area that we still face tremendous challenges. You do, I do. That's the big problem. Again, you can have really grim days worrying about it, or you can have days where you think, if I go out in a blaze of glory today, at least we did a great report this week.
That's right. But the fundraising is daunting. I'm learning that. I am certainly learning that. I want to go back to something you said at the very beginning as we opened the interview, because we're coming to the end of it. You commented when you were talking about the mine workers and the situation that they were in about how things are changing in the United States. Journalists like you are in a particularly good position. You're moving around all the time. You're shifting your attention from this to that. You're like a scanner looking across the society, watching all the things that blow up. And over time, you get a sense of what's happening that isn't easily replicated by anybody else. So I want our listeners and our viewers to get the benefit. Tell us, and I know this is an enormous question, what is happening in the United States? How do you see, given your years of covering so much in this country, and don't gloss over and don't sugarcoat it, tell us, what do you think is happening from your perspective?
Well, first off, it's that extraordinary opportunity to do the sort of work that you just described that makes what I do so great, fundraising notwithstanding. It's been an extraordinary privilege, for example, to be able to go and cover the Pittston strike in 1989, as I did when I was, I don't know, 20, and go back all these years later and follow up. I think something really interesting is happening, and your work points at this. We've had three different types of U.S. economy. We've had kind of U.S. economy 1.0, you could say the craft economy, people doing their local crafts and hands-on work, producing a shoe, a gatepost, a fence. Then we had capitalism, U.S. economy 2.0, if you like, industry, the trade-offs that we've been talking about. All right, I'll give you my health, you'll make energy wealth, I'll get some health benefits back. Workers signed up with a boss, expected to be with that boss till 66 or 61, as you describe. This is a different place. We're now living in a place where, in an economy where a worker can work on a Monday for a retail store, on a Wednesday for a restaurant, and on a Friday be, I don't know, picking through waste metal at the recycling dump. That worker in a course of a week can work for three different employers or none, and maybe on the side has a little internet business or a barter business doing braiding and babysitting for their family and their neighbor's kids. Workers, in a sense, as I'm telling the story, are returning back to the kind of individual life experience that the old craftsperson had, you know, in the 1760s. But this time with a very different context. And there's good and bad to it, in the same way there's good and bad to the internet. Sure, we don't have the stable around the water cooler conversations prompted by network television. Instead, we have this superfluity of media outlets and nobody's talking about the same stuff. So too at work, we're losing the power of our big unions. We're losing the security that came from that kind of institution. We're having to look at one another and decide how can we together cooperate to preserve some rights and to secure some place on this planet. And I think that's what you're seeing with the growth of these new worker organizations, the restaurant workers, domestic workers, fast food workers, car wash workers. I think the old unions are going to be looking around and saying, what is it here we have yet to understand? What do we have to learn? And it speaks to the diversity that exists in this country. Because let's face it, everybody didn't have those secure jobs. Everybody didn't have that security. Even in the craft era, crafts viciously maintained their exclusivity from the Irish or the African American or the enslaved person or the immigrant. More and more of us are in that immigrant boat as we migrate from job to job, day after day, maybe there's hope there as well as desperation. I certainly think we're going to see change on some basic things. No longer can your health insurance be attached to your job. It makes no sense. So I think it's a crisis and opportunity, like that great Chinese character.
Yes, it always does that. I would add, just because you provoke you provoke it in the best sense of the term, that we have to face the fact that there are two options. There might be a reconstitution of a labor movement that sees these new conditions, just as you described them, as a challenge that can mobilize new forms of organization that can provide people with decent livelihoods, decent job situations, educations for their children, and so on. That's one option. That may happen, and I sure hope so. But the other one is that the old industrial world, North America, Europe, Japan, is simply being abandoned by the capitalists, moving production to where it's cheaper, where they don't have any environmental controls, where they are freer to do what they want, and saying to the old parts of the world, including the United States, make it worth our while not to leave. And what they mean is recreate in Cincinnati the conditions of Bangladesh, recreate in Chicago what you have in China, and live at that scale, or we don't care what you do. It really is a stark choice between these two directions, and everything will depend on whether the mass of the American people rise to this situation or they don't. And, you know, it's going to be fascinating, but also a little bit terrifying as that choice gets made in the provocations of a shift, which is at the initiative of capitalists for their own benefits and everybody else. You're on your own.
Do we have time for me to respond?
Please.
So one little response to that, and you can again say, oh, that's Pollyanna Laura. But I do think that the U.S. media terrifies Americans about everywhere else. The horror that is Greece. The horror that is Italy. Go to Italy. Go to Greece. They're in economic crisis today. But they're in economic crisis over a fight around expectations that we have yet to even embrace in this country. The expectation of a vacation, the expectation of a workday that ends, the expectation of time and health to eat at leisure with your friends and family, food that actually has a flavor that you can taste. The lifestyle in many of the places, even the poor communities that we're told are so terrifying, is something that I think a lot of Americans kind of miss. The hours Americans are working far outpaces anything in the countries that I've just mentioned, especially, of course, in their crisis. But the hours Americans work are in a league of their own.
Absolutely.
And it's killing us. And so I think a massive transition is incredibly uncomfortable. And there isn't a hunky-dory, rosy, localist solution out there. But could we do with reconsidering the lifestyle that's been sold to us by consumerism and corporate pressure? I think so. And we might find things we like.
I think that's a good response. But those issues are coming to a head in this society. And the statistic I sometimes mention, but it's appropriate, the OECD, the same institution, indicates that the American people do more hours of paid labor per year than any other working class in any other country on this planet. So there's the proof. We are working 26 jobs. Everyone in the household is working. We barely have households left. You know, 20 years ago, the standard sitcom had a family with a father with a tie and a jacket coming home for work, the mother at the home taking care of the kids and cooking. All of that's gone. Now we have sitcoms in which everybody's working and nobody gets along with anybody else. And we all think it's funny because it's giving us relief from our own situation.
And one in four of us works for low-paying jobs. In Greece, it's one in 12.
Thank you, Laura, as always. I appreciate it. This is a wonderful journalist. If you catch Laura Flanders anywhere on the internet or elsewhere in her writing, this is a person who thinks long and hard, and it's a pleasure to have her on the program, and I urge you to take a look at her work. In the final minutes of our program today, I want to respond to one or two of your questions. Several of you wrote to me this last week at asking about the Apple Corporation because it was in the news so much. So I thought I would comment in response to your questions, which were, what did Apple do and what's wrong with it? Apple got caught in public doing something, but it's what every corporation that can do it in this country has been doing for a long time. So I'm going to talk about Apple, but I want to begin by saying this: everything I say about Apple is not unique to Apple. It's just that Apple is a big corporation, it's very famous, and it is widely looked upon as some sort of exception. And partly what happened last week is it's revealed as not being so exceptional. Here's what it did. Apple is active in a lot of different countries, selling its Apple products, whether they be computers or iPods or all the rest of it, and they're famous for doing that. When you're active in a lot of countries, you begin to look at all of those countries in terms of deciding where you're going to locate production, where you're going to locate the distribution systems, how you're going to do your global business, and where you're going to locate your facilities. And as you look at that question, your accountants and your lawyers point out to you, don't forget that what you ought to look at is not just what kind of workers you have in that country, what kind of wages you have to pay, but also pay attention to what the tax rates are, because countries differ in the taxes they levy on corporate profits. One of the countries that has the lowest tax rate on corporate profits, and that's been true for 20 years, is Ireland. And Ireland did that in order to lure companies to come to Ireland, to create jobs for the Irish people who need them, to create tax revenue for the Irish government, which will be created if a company locates in Ireland, and all the rest. Fairly straightforward. And so they offer a much lower tax rate. Now, Apple then says, as do many other corporations, if my business that earns me, say, $50 billion of revenue a year around the world, if that revenue shows up as my profits here in the United States, I'm going to have to pay the corporate income tax rate of the United States, currently 35%. But if instead those profits show up on the accounts of my subsidiary, Apple Ireland, or whatever it's called, in Ireland, then they're subject to the tax rate of Ireland, which these days is around 10%. In other words, way, 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 way less. It then becomes very easy to create four or five companies that move Apple products around amongst them. By the way, they don't move actually physically. They just move in terms of invoices and a record sheet. So you show up. You can easily arrange for your profits to show up as profits earned by your Irish subsidiary and therefore taxable under the Irish law rather than your American home-based company. And that's what Apple did. It moved its operations so that it could book, that's what they call it, book their profits where the taxes were the lowest. Straightforward corporate management of their funds. But what it means is when those corporate profits show up in Ireland, it is a low tax rate that the Irish government gets rather than a high tax rate that the American government gets if that were not legal and the American company had to pay its tax here in America on its global profits. Wow. And if the American government doesn't get that money from Apple and Microsoft and General Motors and all the other companies that are doing this, that's a vast cut in the revenue of the United States. But that's then used as an excuse for the sequester, for cutting school lunch programs, for closing schools, for doing all the things we've talked about today and all the rest that you know about, because there isn't enough money. But there is enough money. The problem isn't that there isn't the money. The problem is corporations have helped shape laws, because they were right busy there writing these laws, giving them the legal opportunity to evade taxes. And all last week, Apple was caught doing that. So for those of you who think Apple is different than every other corporation, I'm sure in some ways it is. But in terms of pushing for the tax laws they want and using them to get the advantages they want, Apple is no different from most other large corporations. One change in the law could solve this problem, generating huge amounts of tax revenue for the government, avoiding half of the so-called cutbacks that we're told are absolutely necessary. And all we would be doing is getting the taxes out of these corporations that the tax law was originally designed to get, and which these super profitable corporations can and will easily afford. Last part of this. When you allow this, you're creating what is called a race to the bottom. Ireland gets an advantage by dropping its tax rate. Well, what is the response here in the United States? This last week we saw it. Forbes magazine, a magazine for big business in America, proposed a zero corporate tax rate in the United States, and the logic was impeccable. You want companies not to book their profits in Ireland or any other country? Make it worth their while. They'll come home and give jobs here to Americans if you just don't tax them at all. Now, you beat Ireland at its game, which means every other country that wants to survive will have to match that by cutting taxes on corporations. Isn't that wonderful? Countries competing to tax corporations less. The corporations will be laughing all the way to the bank. How interesting it is that we are told we must compete with countries like Ireland when it comes to cutting the burden on corporations. But do we have to compete with Ireland and every other European country in having a national health plan that covers everybody in a humane and decent way? What the British and the French and the Italians and the Swedish, and they all do? No. Suddenly there, we don't need to compete. We don't need to hear about competition. Competition is one of those wonderful ideas you only bring in when it's useful to your partisan interest as a capitalist. That's what Apple was exposed doing last week, and that's why it's an important story. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update. I hope you will join me again next week. And for follow-up on all that we've discussed, rdwolff.com and democracyatwork.info are the places to pursue. Talk to you again next week. What a day. Ain't gonna change. Your time now, baby. After a while, gonna do mine, gonna be mine. One of these days, babe. I'm moaning, droning, babe.